you know, make it look like you're serving more black people than maybe you are, because you still need that money to serve more black people. So these are problems. And I think also, you know, nonprofits, you know, involve us all in a very vicious loop where you get funded, your job is to help people who are in a difficult situation. So then people being stuck in a tough situation guarantees that you have a job. And I think that that's very, very dangerous. So there are a lot of us out there who are always kind of asking, like, is it even a good idea that we're getting paid to do this work, right? So I think while it's important that nonprofits exist as a step, I think that ultimately real transformative work has to happen very much outside of that system. And so what do we do? So I personally believe in projects that focus on redirecting the surplus resources that are produced by the capitalist system towards a true common good. And in a nutshell, that's volunteerism, right? That's basically what any volunteer project is about doing. I also believe in projects that redefine what community resources are by a non-capitalist value system, which is mutual aid in a nutshell. Like, that's what mutual aid is. I think it's really important to recognize that one of the reasons why capitalism is so deeply ingrained in us and so strongly exists within our sphere is that it presents itself as a value and an ethical system as well as an economic system. So it's important that any strategies that we develop to combat it present another set of values, a different ethics, okay? So again, it's about, oh, shit. So it's transformation, not reformation. So later on I can talk more about some of the anarchist projects that I'm involved in that are really about mutual aid practices and volunteerism. But I think I just want to sort of close out by saying that I feel like if you're employing strategies that are really about volunteerism and about the practice of mutual aid, the potential for engagement of many different kinds of people in many different communities is really high, because these are ideas that are familiar to us and are very attractive to us. I think mutual aid is an instinct that human beings have. I think there's a reason why when babies are born, they can't stand or do anything for themselves. You know, we're born into a system in which we are codependent on other human beings to have our needs met. So it's sort of, we're evolved to give and give back and take and receive from each other. So it makes sense. And so I think any effective strategies that we talk about now have to emerge from an understanding of human beings as innately social creatures, that we're innately social, and it's important that we're dependent on one another. So I'll end there.
Thank you, everyone. So a little time check. It's 9 o'clock right now. So we're going to go...
Oh my God.
We're going to go into about 25 minutes of kind of interpanel conversation before breaking out into a larger discussion. And a lot of thoughts and ideas just brought up by all the panelists. U.S. imperialism post-Bush, prefigurative politics, perhaps then and now, and what they mean for our movements, how the left relates to electoral strategies. Building our own alternatives in the vacuum of the state, in the vacuum of 30 years of Reaganomics. I think I wanna start though with the question that Igen posed. The need to build ties between existing left formations, and within that maybe, and you don't have to respond to this. I mean, everyone can respond to these questions. Within that, who do you actually see as being part of the left currently, in kind of a period of, as Max described, defensiveness? How far would you cast that net?
By left, I think people who believe that capitalism can't be reformed, that people who are fundamentally believe that capitalism can't be reformed and that we need to do away with it and create something different. Is that the question you want to see?
Yeah, and then basically, check. You got that one.
So, I think individuals and organizations who think that, I think we would prioritize groups who are doing work that's based in communities of color within the working class, who are committed to leadership from oppressed communities and working class communities. Groups that have real work that's changing and making a difference in the lives of oppressed communities and working class communities. So I wouldn't say that like every organization that identifies as anti-capitalist necessarily is an organization or an individual that, you know, we prioritize, but that there's a tremendous amount of basis for unity among different forces who believe that capitalism isn't reformed, that we haven't actually made the most of at this point, is I think the point that I was trying to make around left unity. And that I think that, like, with whether it's the anarchist traditions or the different international examples that I think people have pointed to, I think that there's a tremendous amount of, I began by saying that what we want is to build a vibrant social movement in this country that's fundamentally connected to vibrant social movements around the world. And I think that a movement is by definition many, many ideologies, many minds, many people, many voices, and also many models of social change and transformation within it. And so I think that whether it's creating institutions that are about mutual aid and economic alternatives, I think that that is part of a movement, a vibrant social movement. I think that other types of organizations, nonprofits can be, not all of them are, but they can be part of a vibrant social movement. I think that there's different, that a vibrant social movement that we need to build and strengthen is going to reflect a lot of different political and ideological trends and voices and traditions.
Well, in 1970, I was working in a hospital in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and involved in labor organizing in the anti-Vietnam War movement. And one of the people who was a volunteer there was a member of the Socialist Labor Party, I think, or the Socialist Party. He was in his 70s, and he had a long history of being involved in the left, and we were friends. And he told me most of the, we were friends, and we discussed, but he wasn't involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement. And I asked him why, and he says, the problem is capitalism. You're wasting your time on the Vietnam War. The problem is capitalism. And, you know, we agreed and disagreed. He was my comrade. We agreed the problem was capitalism, but we didn't agree about what we should do about the anti-Vietnam War movement. And to me, that's the difficulty of left unity, frankly. I'm for left unity. I agree with the point. I don't think we should divide into different camps and battle about all that. But the problem is that in the society, the question isn't capitalism or a different society, however defined. That's not the question that's thrown up at us by the society, by the objective circumstances. A different set of questions are thrown up. They have to do with the Iraq War, universal health care, immigrant rights, Jannah. There are those questions, electoral questions especially, given that most people in this country view politics as elections. We don't, but they do. So where you stand on those questions tends to determine more who you actually are identified with as a current in the society, how it looks at politics, not how we look at politics. So even though we should strive, absolutely, for a different set of relationships on the left, the way the society is going to look at us and the way masses will look at us, for example, we all believe, I think, that we need social movements, we need, you know, all of those things. But right now, the society looks at you, if you're somewhere on the progressive end of the spectrum, people want to know, are you for building movements? Are you for building a third party? Are you for supporting Obama or Hillary with their limitations? And that's how things get sorted out. And people find themselves working with other people who are not leftists, depending on which choice they make in that. Now, the old way was to regard people who made a different choice than you as the enemy or the rival and polemicize to the death. And you're not part of the left. You're part of the phony left, or you're part of the ultra left, or you're part of the revisionist. I mean, I know all the language, revision, you know, whatever. That's got to go. But we will make those different choices. And I suspect, this is probably not all that popular in his point of view, but I suspect that the maximum unity will come about where people who agree on those kinds of questions, the ones that are thrown up at us by the society, struggle to build the most mature, sophisticated, and developed current based upon their assessment in relation to those questions, and try to have a comradely and cooperative relationship with people who make other choices. But a view that says the left will unite and become a coherent force across those differences, I'm not talking about the isms, but I'm talking about the ones that are thrown up in the concrete by the society, I just don't believe that's going to work.
I want to really understand what you're saying, Max, too. So he's saying that the current gets developed through popular engagement with the questions of the Iraq War, Gina 6, Gulf Coast crisis, that what you're trying to like really push is that it's through that active engagement that then we're going to develop that current.
I think the people who have, I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but basically, yes.
Okay.
and I actually think that, an example of it is actually our work together, you know? So, the Child Care Collective and domestic, I organized with an organization called Domestic Workers United, which is an organization of nannies, housekeepers, and elderly caregivers organizing for power, respect, and fair labor standards and to help build a broader movement here in New York. And we're working on a campaign to establish basic labor standards for domestic workers. And over the course of the last year, precisely because the working conditions in this industry are so at the whim and mercy of employers, and there's so much abuse. It's basically like the Wild West. There's no labor rights. There's no labor standards. And people are completely vulnerable to their employers. And so over the course of the last year, the Child Care Collective and Domestic Workers United have done work together, and the Child Care Collective has been consistently supporting the development of programs like English classes and other classes for domestic workers to actually come together and organize. So I think that in terms of the real-life conditions that get thrown up that are happening, that there is a way that we're already in conversation and actually working together on that. So I don't know if that's an example of something that would fit what you were saying. But.
Too many wires. Maybe folks can talk about it. I've heard the argument made sometimes that in the wake of this kind of like 30-year backlash coming out of the height of the social movements in the 60s and early 70s, the state has taken back a lot of the concessions that were won over years and years of struggle. And in that wake, specifically talking about things like social services, there lies an opportunity for organizers who are looking to actually provide some of those services to the general population, both as a way of organizing workers, but then also as a way of actually prefiguring a different kind of society where people are not dependent on the system, but can be dependent on social and community organizations to fulfill those needs. Do you think that this is a helpful argument or a helpful way sometimes to look at some of the possibilities that we're seeing right now? Or do you think that we're going to be so limited in the kinds of things right now that our movements can provide that we do have to keep looking at these larger structures and these larger kind of battles that we have to keep fighting with, specifically with the state, around a multiplicity of struggles?
Well, ROCDEV does a lot of thinking and talking about this. ROCDEV Collective, which is a collective that I'm a part of and Alana is a part of, is a radical community health exchange is what we call it. We basically organize health practitioners who are willing to offer their services in exchange for mutual aid. So it's kind of setting up a bartering system around healthcare. I mean, we collect lots of other kinds of information about free and low-cost services and all that kind of good stuff. But the idea is to build networks of care where the needs of the practitioner, concrete physical needs of that practitioner, are taken into account just as much as the needs of the person who's seeking healthcare. And I think this is a perfect example of that sort of alternative system, that idea of dual power. Is it effective? I think at the localist level, yes, it is very effective. I think in terms of building long-term effective personal relationships within the movement, it's incredibly effective, and that's really important. I think we often forget how important it is that we like each other and get along. But I think also something that ROCDEV, that a place that we operate from, and something that I think it would really behoove folks in the movement to really think about is, how fast do you want this change? We operate from the fact that if we really want this change to happen, then we have to be willing to let it happen slowly. We've committed ourselves to building very slowly and to not doing anything that would be dangerous to the health of our group, that would split us apart. And oftentimes that's trying to grow too fast and trying to build too fast and build too big. That's oftentimes, I think, just that urgency that I think is very much a product of the Netscape age. Sorry, the technological age. I think that's very much that urgent need to have it happen big and have it happen fast and have it happen now is a huge part of why we see our projects failing again and again. And I think if we make a commitment to have it happen, but have it happen at a pace that actually makes sense, and a pace that people can work at. So folks can, you know, we have lots of folks who are part of our network who don't identify as anarchists and aren't particularly political, but they want to have a rich and generous life, you know? They want to have a fulfilling life. I think that's also important. You know, quality of life is really important. So that's my response.
I think that there's that question that Ai-Jen pointed to of, like, where you are, when are you there, what's going on, and that more than a sort of pat answer, oh no, the way is total autonomy, I'm not going to engage with the state at all, or the way is seize the state, or the way is something else. Those questions are fun to debate, but I think there's a moment where you actually are dealing with a specific situation and you have to make some decisions. And I think that it's really helpful for us to take that perspective when we're kind of addressing this question of, the deterioration of the wealth, the destruction of the welfare state, and kind of how do we engage that? Do we try to win those gains back, or do we try to build an alternative? I mean, that stuff is going to come in that moment. And some things, and I think another thing that's helpful with this question is not to look at the state as a sort of single entity, but to actually recognize that the state is a collection. It's sort of like a machine of machines is what, you know, one way of putting it. There's a collection of things. So we might decide to totally not engage with the criminal legal system because it's totally broken. But we might actually decide to try and fight and defend and rebuild the public education system. Because we're dealing with two separate sort of social forces that control those pieces of this larger machine of machines called the state. So I mean, my analysis is in the case of the criminal legal system, it's actually going to be really helpful for us to build some stuff that's completely outside of it. I think it's within our means, and I think that it's more of a question, it's more of a technical question. It's more that we have to develop the techniques to address that. In the case of the public education system, I think absolutely we need to figure out ways and capacities for communities to educate themselves, to break out of all that. And at the same time, we should defend the gains that we still have. So, you know, in Ijen kind of was talking about the way that our two groups work together, and I don't even think our groups are comparable in certain ways. And part of that has to do with our particular histories and what it makes sense for us to be doing right now, what we've decided it makes sense for us to be doing. And, you know, for myself, I feel like it, for a lot of different reasons, some of them personal, some of them political, I think it makes sense to organize people in their 20s, people in their 30s mostly, people that are mobile, coming in and out of New York City for the most part, into a project that is going to be a place where you're going to get some face-to-face, hands-on experience with women of color, queer parents of color, organizing for change. And the strategies that those organizations are using, the strategies of the organizations that we partner with, are oftentimes very different and are addressing the same questions and going different ways. And we're working with a bunch of them. So, you know, that's more for those groups to decide, right? And we have our politics and we engage and it's rich. You know, so everything is sort of situated in our different histories and in those contexts and what it makes sense for us to do.
Well, I think a lot of the work that's being described, and let me, the U.S. Social Forum brought up, this is the kind of base building work that a lot of the groups at the U.S. Social Forum are doing around healthcare, around, you know, filling those cracks, around gentrification, the Right to the City Network, working around those kinds of issues, the people working around immigrant rights issues, and the stuff that's happening in Mississippi, in particular with the Black Latino Alliance that's under construction there. So all that kind of work, I think that that's been some of the best work that's gone on in the last while, and I think it's great. Let me put it this way, though. I can conceive of a moment, given, say, what's happening with healthcare, where the national healthcare, universal healthcare, single payer really is on the agenda, because there are sectors of the ruling class for whom that's now a sensible reform. Those cracks are there. Who should be leading that? I say that people from some of these grassroots groups should figure out some division of labor where someone from this group can catapult themselves into being a national leader in this struggle. Same thing around Right to the Cities and foreclosures. People are losing their homes. People are being cooked out of their homes. If you read the histories of the 1930s, not letting people getting booted out of their homes was one of the main campaigns the Communist Party did that, you know, they literally moved the furniture back in. You've seen Salt of the Earth when they tried to kick people out of their homes, the Chicano women, you know, and going around the house and putting people in. People from the Right to the City Network, if the opportunity arises, should be the national leadership proposing legislation. No one gets kicked out of their homes. It's absolutely an anti-racist issue. The highest percentage of people getting kicked out of their homes are African-Americans, Latinos next. It's an issue around subprime mortgages. They've done every study. If you're black, you get a subprime mortgage at a higher rate than if you're white making the same damn amount of money. So the thing is, at what point is there an opening in the society to break to scale, which is the issue that confronts people at the U.S. Social Forum? It's a fantastic event, but how do you get out of organizations that have 50 members, 100 members, 500 members, and reach 1 million members? Martin Luther King was a preacher in a local struggle in Montgomery, Alabama, that got catapulted to national prominence about after the bus boycott, because the issue of segregation and Jim Crow became such a national issue and a local struggle, which when they, if you read the histories of it, they didn't expect it to be like this. They had no crystal ball. So the people in this room should be thinking of sitting here as the next Martin Luther King. Sitting here as the next Jesse Jackson, Julian Bond, Ella Baker. You can bust to scale based on the work that you have already done in the trenches. And how do you get your division of labor, your out of the bunker mentally, and then the division of labor within the organizations that you can throw up a leader who will then be accountable to the oppressed communities? Because somebody's going to fill that space, and if it's not going to be somebody from this room, you can damn sure it's going to be somebody else.
Okay, last question, then we're going to open it up to the floor. I know it's starting to get late. It's about 9:30. So last question, kind of dovetailing off of this division of labor and kind of bringing it back to some of the other themes that were brought up. I'm going to read just the opening few sentences from a piece that Max just wrote around the five-year anniversary of the war in Iraq. And it just happens to be published in a really amazing magazine that is called Vibe Magazine. called Left Turn Magazine, which I also helped to edit. And the new issue just came out a few days ago. I think there's some copies at the table. So Max writes, if the U.S. can be forced to withdraw completely from Iraq, many more positive changes become possible. But if the U.S. continues its military occupation, every problem facing people here in Iraq and across the globe will get worse. No constituency and no issue is exempt from this reality. If out of, say, a collective study process, and Aijen, you mentioned this earlier, something comes to the forefront, for example, around the centrality of the Iraq War. My question would be, in terms of a division of labor, how does that work when you're in a room with grassroots organizers who are doing base building work, who are working full time, who are in school, who are working around a whole myriad of issues? How does this study inform, and how do you either change or based on the study, how do you then engage with, let's say, in this case, the most pressing issue, the war in Iraq? And is that a fair, is that a fair question to ask?
I basically think that that every single issue that we would be fighting around on the ground in grassroots organizations is fundamentally connected to the war. Everything we want, healthcare, housing, labor rights, all of these things that we want, we can't have if the war continues. And so I think it's like, I think we have to figure out both politically how to connect the work that we're doing on the ground to the broader anti-war movement, but we've got to put that movement building work front and center and really make sure that we're a part of it, we're engaged with it, and we're bringing forward the contributions and creativity and energy that grassroots organizations have to offer. I think what's difficult is that there doesn't seem to be a strong coordinated strategy among all the different anti-war organizations where we could see clearly what the specific role and contribution of grassroots organizations would be. I think that if that existed, it would be a lot easier. But so I'll just put that out there. And so I think that if we are in a position coming out of the social forum as grassroots organizations to call for that unity and try to make it happen, then that should be a priority, that we should encourage that level of coordination. Not that everyone should do the same thing, definitely not, but that we should at the very least, be able to say, to clearly articulate a division of labor and a coordination of strategies, so that each action that each network is doing is helping to amplify and lift up the others. And then I think that we should think about, as grassroots organizations, what's our particular role and contribution to this struggle, based off of where it means something in the hearts and minds of our members, and I think it does. Half of our leadership has kids who are in Iraq, and I think it's, if they don't, they might soon. So I think it's not something that's so far from what we're already doing in terms of protecting the rights and dignity of our community. So
that's. I don't exactly know how this is going to relate, but something that I've been struggling with in terms of the anti-war movement, that I'm just interested to see if other people in the room are struggling with, is this issue of analysis versus experience. From the perspective of analysis, absolutely the war is one of the most pressing issues of our time. From the perspective of experience, I know that the high schoolers that I work with every day don't experience the war as a pressing issue in their lives at all. It's not something they think about. It's not something they talk about. When we do talk about it, it's very clear that they don't have a real understanding of what's at stake or even what's happening. And so I think any organizing that happens around doing anti-war work has to really engage that question of how are people experiencing the personal impact of the war in their lives, in their families? How are people actually experiencing it? Not how we think they might be experiencing it, not how we're experiencing it, but how are people experiencing it? Because I think it might be a little different. I know it's different from the high schoolers.
Shall we open up? Okay. So, for folks who have to get going, thank you for joining us tonight. We're gonna continue with about 15-20 minutes of discussion, and then we're gonna wrap it up. So I'm gonna take a few questions at once from the floor, and then I'll let folks answer them in bunches. Daniel. I'm going to take three first. Go ahead.
Just in a nutshell, I've heard a lot of optimism of the will expressed from around the table, and I think it's generally well taken, but I think Max was hinting at it, and I think iGen was as well, is that there is a reason for a little bit of the pessimism of the intellect with regard to 2008. And just in particular, it seems like with crises like the subprime mortgage crisis, the ongoing crisis in Katrina, et cetera, we are really getting our ass kicked in terms of economic crisis. And as I think Max expressed in his book, the left really has not been able to address economic crises the way that it thinks that it can. And even to the extent that, like, in terms of my generation and the generation of the bulk of the panelists, I mean, 2001, when the towers went down, I don't know whether we really lost because all of a sudden there's this Afghan war so much as there's this dot-com collapse and everybody's grant money is beginning to evaporate. So I would say the question is, how do we address the issue of an economic crisis where it's not, we're not playing Chicken Little and saying, you know, the whole shit, you know, the whole shit house is going to go up in flames. But on the other hand, we're not, you know, we're not just saying, oh yeah, eventually the workers will be, will come over to our side. They'll see how rotten the system is. Because if anything, the 1970s and since then have shown that we lose people due to these crises.
My question is two part. One is, why are the anarchists the people with really cool hair? That's what I want.
Because we're losing it.
Secondly, why are the anarchists the people with the really cool hair? The other thing, okay, the other question I really need help with this. I need advice, and no, every organization I'm in has debated this, and I cannot. It's like when I was a political science undergrad and I tried to find the difference between Democrats and Republicans and no one could really tell me either. Let's talk about Obama. What, you know, so my question is, so this is big groundswell, but like everyone in this room, really pretty much everyone in all the organizations that we're in could just work for the Obama campaign. It probably wouldn't put a dent in it, okay? That campaign is functioning, you know, it's going with the momentum that it has, but how do we speak to Obama and how do we speak to all of this, the youth that's hopeful about it when he loses? And what do we do with this group of people who are hopeful about it when he wins and there's no real change for the working class? You know, and how do we talk about Obama now to set us up to deal with it, that in a year? And, you know, I have people who I never thought who are just going, Obama, he represents hope, you know, like, what is that? What the hell? You know, I mean, it's like, I need to know how to deal with Obama. And, you know,
Obama. Just kiss a picture of him every day.
Hey, how's it going? My name is Peter. A lot of people on the panel, first I'd like to thank you. I think you guys are amazing. You inspired me. I'm glad for hearing your analysis. A lot of you, my friends, you're all my comrades. I do, however, have some real theoretical and political differences. I'm not going to air them all, but I would say concretely, like, as somebody working, you know, coming from both a U.S. and a Canadian kind of political left trade union experience, there's some real things that need to be said in terms of, like, you know, what's possible? What do we push people to do? What's the objective conditions and how do we move those things, right? Like, in terms of U.S. trade union activism here in the United States, it might be said or thought that it's crazy to think about people organizing around Palestine here. And the exact same thing is true within the Canadian context, and yet we passed resolutions and the largest union in Canada to, you know, to say Israel is a fucking apartheid state and we're going to boycott and we're going to, you know, try to impose sanctions and divest from it. You know, and that was a rank and file left, not just a rank and file Democratic movement, but a left, you know, movement of activists to push that. Same thing can be, it can happen here and I'm working to kind of create that. But just to say, like, what's possible? What do we do? How do we organize around it? I think, you know, Max Album, for instance, I think you have a lot of really rich, important history and experience to bring to these conversations. And I feel like a lot of that is kind of left to the side when you kind of look around at, like, what's Obama mania? What's happening? How do we engage with the activism around Obama? Right? And what do we do with that? You know, it's like, okay, what do we do with that? But how do we push that in different directions? Really much, much more left directions, much more directions like, how do we create a different world? You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of like, let's push the boundaries, you know what I mean? And let's think about that. Let's not limit ourselves. So I just want people to comment on that and think about that in a more realistic way. Like, yeah, okay, how do we engage with people that are excited about Obama and the elections this year? That's great. But how do we do that concretely when we're actually pushing the limits?
And it is actually Peter's birthday, so.
And it is my birthday.
Okay, well. Here I go. Far right wing of this conversation. First of all, I think the reasons the anarchists have the coolest hair is because anarchism in the last 5 years or 10 years has brought the freshest sensibility to the left. I have my political and strategic differences. I have my political and strategic differences with some of what my friends who are anarchists say, but I think that the anarchists deserve the credit for changing the climate and bringing a democratic and very fresh sensibility to the left. And that's a contribution that whatever ideology people hold, we should all be grateful for that and try to grab onto it. Okay, I think the questions of what's possible and how to relate to Obama are very closely related. My own opinion is that the main drama going on in world politics today is the question of whether we will transition to a multipolar world where there's a measure of conflict resolution and some attempt on a global scale to tackle problems of global warming and certain other problems that threaten the human race, or whether the U.S. will prevail in its militaristic form of maintaining hegemony. I think that's the main drama on a world scale right now, and that almost every force in the world wants to end U.S. hegemony, but not confront the U.S. head-on because you get bludgeoned. And that's the drama about whether Iraq, which, as somebody said, I think it was RJ, was supposed to introduce remodel in the Middle East. Instead, it showed the weakness of U.S. military power. That's the main drama. In the 1960s and 70s, we thought the end of U.S. hegemony meant revolution around the world, that a part of the world had gone over to the anti-capitalist system and the third world was going to break free. But that's not the way the world's worked out. And the end of U.S. hegemony is not going to result in revolution or socialism or anarchism or counter-system. It can, at best, in the next decade or two, result in a new constellation of forces in the world where there is a multipolar world. Every other transition in the history of capitalism from one hegemonic power to another arrangement has been through bloody wars. And if that's the way it comes down this time, the human race is in grave danger, because a war between the U.S. and China, we are talking about grave, grave destruction. And even continuing Iraq another decade and a half, given the intersection of oil and the climate crisis, you're talking about hundreds of millions of people at risk. So that's the drama on a world scale. I think in U.S. politics, the combination of a certain popular revulsion against Bushism and a different bloc in the ruling class. Obama represents... There's a sector of finance capital that's behind Obama, Wall Street capital, as opposed to the energy military complex, which was behind the oil complex behind Bush and McCain, that is not principally concerned with the Iraq war. They're willing to let that go, although they don't want to see the U.S. humiliated. They're committed to U.S. hegemony, but they are not as wedded to a certain vision of the Middle East. They don't care about certain social rights the way the right wing does. They're not beholden to the Christian coalition on those issues. And they may be willing to cut a deal with a labor movement that has a little more oomph because of the sectors that they're in and where they think. So we are possibly in a period of reform, which would be more analogous to the New Deal than it would be analogous to something else. The way you deal with the economic crisis has got to be a revitalized public sector, which is the reversal of neoliberalism. You have to revitalize the role of the state, not in the way that it's played to privatize, but in a different way. Public works, national health care, equality, and multipolar world. That is a realizable program in the next decade or decade and a half. And Obama is the closest thing to a candidate that is pressurable to get there. What the left should have done, if we'd had a crystal ball and we'd have been organized 4 years ago, was to get in there and be a force in this campaign. And the individual leftists that I know who did do have some influence. There's a reason Obama said in Texas, "I'll end the war in 1 year," whereas before he was saying 18 months. No, it's not our line. But he changed. His initial line on the foreclosure issue was worse than it became because people have his ear. And we should not wait and have the same discussion 6 months before the election in 2012. Part of our current, I believe, is I'm saying I'm on the right wing of this conversation, has to be in to the Democratic Party, which is where the mass of workers, black people, Latinos, are voting, and has to try to exert some clout there. Now, other people have other points of view. They do have a different theoretical analysis of what might be possible. There's debates about all of these issues. I'm for putting them on the table because the strategies do flow from a certain assessment of the world situation and what class forces and what is possible. If you think revolution is possible in the United States in the next 10 or 15 years, then we probably differ. And, you know, that's I'm not pessimistic. I don't know what, you know, I'm incredibly optimistic. I think a period of reform, I don't think it can be skipped. I think it's a direction. I don't think the masses break from reform because of they break from it when it exhausts itself and they feel that they've worked hard for it and it's not enough. And I don't think that stage can be skipped. It's not going to be skipped and we're going to have to pass through it and we better be in there fighting for the most influence we can. And I completely respect that there are people with another point of view, want to build a third party or think the whole electoral system, you know, if you vote, you're legitimizing the bourgeoisie. They're my comrades. We'll cooperate every place that we can, but we're probably going to have different points of view on where we're headed in the next little while and what our priorities are. That's fine. What else is new? There have been differences in politics for 5,000 years. It's not going to go away next week.
I think this is an interesting line to continue on, so I think we should go with it. So I would be to the left of Max, too, on this one, as he predicted, correctly predicted. I'm not actively out there trying to disorganize anyone that's engaged in the Obama campaign. I think that if Obama were to become the next president, there would be some important symbolic victories that could give us that sort of emotional boost that we can build on and that we can also sort of shift at that point. Obama's point is great. It would be a shift from energy and military to financial capital. And we really would have to understand that and understand what that's going to look like. I mentioned earlier that I'm part of a study group called Another Politics is Possible. So I know there are a few things that I can say that we've thought of. And what we mean when we say Another Politics is Possible is that we want to shoot for some things that we've seen that we want to really make possible. That it's not that it's possible right now, but it's that like we see that we can get there. And what we're studying and what we're trying to articulate or what we're trying to understand is the possibility of building large-scale movements that are as democratic as possible. And that we think that some of this, I think, or at least I'm going to say I think, sometimes becomes a technical question. It becomes what mechanisms have we created to make that possible? And if we're busy focused on something else, like if we're going to enter the Democratic Party or if we're going to build maybe a party structure that's more hierarchical, then we're focused on that. And we're not focused on coming up with some ways that we can do things better. And so it's to say that, yeah, a lot of people are going to go for Obama, a lot of people are going to do other things, and we're going to try and create something else. And I think no matter what piece of work any person tries to do, the important thing is to try and do it, and try and do it well. You know, so I don't think necessarily we have to take a line on Obama or everyone has to take a line on Obama. Some of us have to choose some work and try to do it well. And what we want to try and figure out how to do is how can we organize on a large scale as democratically as possible that has people most targeted by these systems of oppression leading the way in that, that we're prefiguring the world we want to create, and that we're actually consciously connecting this work into a larger movement or a larger movement of movements. And I think that's something that we haven't explicitly said, but I think that a lot of us agree on is that we're not going to just sort of come to some larger coherent movement without consciously trying to do that work. And then we might have different ideas about how we should do that. But each of us, no matter what sort of conclusion we've come to, should try to do that as well as we possibly can. rather than spend a lot of time telling the other person that they're not doing it the right way. I guess it's kind of the way I see a sort of an idea of complementarity and, like, you know, kind of walking in parallel and moving, you know? I used to do that.
Both of those comments I thought were really helpful. I think around the elections question, a comrade named Bill Fletcher, who's spoken here a bunch of times, he often says that until the people feel the limits of this electoral system, they're never going to try to take it apart and build something different. And so I wonder whether, if Obama does become president, which is a huge question at this point, but if he were to become president, whether people would feel, given that the move, the spirit behind the momentum that Obama has, is that feeling that people want change. It's real, you know, that feeling, that sense of discontent, that feeling of wanting something different. Is the wind beneath Obama's wings?
All right, we're gonna actually end it right here.
I wonder if it's gonna put us in a better position once people feel like there's still the same fundamental contradictions around capitalism, around racial oppression, around gender inequality, around all the different things that people have to struggle with every day. And I think that it's up to us as a movement to really make sure that we're able to capitalize off of that. The other thing I think is that this question of climate change is real. I mean, people are saying that in 50 years there'll be no more fish in the sea. You know, people are saying that's real, you know, and I think that what that means is that this question of time is actually really critical. And the question of what happens at that level of policy that Max was talking about is really critical. And in what way are we able in our communities to actually engage and think about that and try to figure out how we start to connect to that and understand it better, I think is really, really pressing. So I just think that if I'm not sure, I don't know where all the where all the different candidates align and what position we'd be in differently. My sense is that there would be more opening around that question in particular of climate change, as Max said. And I think that to buy us a little bit more time to figure out how we create a sustainable Earth is a really important factor in all of this.
I just want to point out quickly that Obama is black. Just in case folks hadn't noticed. Actually, he's mixed. And as a mixed person, I can say that. But I would say, I just want to point out that when it comes to the whole Obama question, I think it's important to recognize that historically in this country, if you're asking for a black leader, you're asking for a radical leader. And so Obama's not a radical leader, but I think the signal is, we're picking up on the signal of what the masses are telling us is we want radical change because we want a black leader. We also, like, the fact that we want a woman in office is a signal that we want radical change, even if the individual and the politics that that person represents is not in and of itself radical. And so I think from the perspective of, like, I'm a consensus trainer and I facilitate consensus process. And what we always do when facilitating consensus process is you're always trying to figure out what are the signals that the group is giving me. How can I pick up on the signals that the group is giving me and use that as my momentum? That's my fuel. That's what's driving us towards this decision that we're going to make together. So I think what we need to be doing is picking up on that signal that this country does want radical change. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Obama and Hillary as our Democratic candidates. Obama would have been assassinated by now if that were not the case, right? He might be assassinated in the next year. It's very possible. But, like, I just think that that's an important signal to pick up on. And so in the question of revolutionary leadership, which iGen was talking about earlier, I think, you know, from a leftist perspective, we're not talking about grooming leaders. We're more talking about doing community building and leaders who emerge from those communities that are the leaders that those communities have decided. These are people who can speak for the work that we want to do. So I think that as a left, if we're going to be building any kind of movement, we have to really be looking to more to communities of color and immigrant communities and seeing who are they picking as the leaders of their communities and how can we support those folks. Because that, I think that signal is so key.
So I'm actually, as an authoritarian leftist, gonna cut this off. We're about to hit 10 o'clock. And oftentimes, a lot of the informal discussions after events like these are really fruitful as well. So I encourage folks to have them. I'm gonna bring us just to a close with a little quote from 1968. And if someone can tell me who this is from, you get a cookie.
Yay! False promises.
Chips Ahoy Chewy. Okay, here we go. Here's the quote.
You know what's at stake.
For too long, those who have... This is hilarious. For too long, those who have led us have viewed politics as the art of the possible. The challenge which faces them and us now is to practice politics as the art of making what appears impossible possible. As the French students wrote on the walls of the Sorbonne, be realistic, demand the impossible. We cannot settle for less. I'm actually just going to tell you who said this. This is.
So you get the cookie?
Sorry, I'm really hungry. This is Hillary Rodham Clinton. May 1969. Thank you to everyone for
You have the best one.